All right. So first, I'm very excited to see so many people here today. And apparently, we have some people participating remotely in Germany, potentially in California, although I imagine they're not awake yet. This lecture is really intended to try to get the people coming from a high energy physics or gravity background on similar footing to people coming from a quantum information background. And of course, the quantum information people are trying to do the same in the gravity lecture. So just to orient you a little bit about quantum information as a field, there's what we'd call quantum information science, which is this thing that has burgeoned since the mid-1990s. And on the theory side, we can kind of break it up into three components. There's the quantum information component, which is really about things like entropy, mutual information, the structure of entanglement, the fact that you can do quantum error correction and how that's done, and the construction of communications protocols and cryptography, how you would send quantum information in the presence of noise, how you'd even just send classical information over quantum mechanical media like optical fiber to take advantage of the quantum mechanical nature of light. And then there's quantum computing. And in the quantum computing side, these are people trying to figure out what you could do with a quantum computer if we ever managed to build one. A big component of that is designing algorithms. So tomorrow, you'll get to learn about Shor's algorithm, which you might not think has much to do with quantum gravity, but the core component of Shor's algorithm actually will be also a core component of any algorithm for simulating quantum field theories on a quantum computer. So actually, it is relevant. There's also the study of fault tolerance, how you'd make a quantum computer robust against noise. Not so relevant for us, and complexity theory, the ultimate limits of what you could do in quantum, with a quantum computer. And surprisingly, most of these things on the board have some relevance. Well, I run the left condensed matter physics. We've known for some time about a strong connection between many of these subjects and condensed matter. And more recently, and that's the nature or the purpose of this collaboration and this school, the links between these fields and these subjects of interest in high energy physics have really been kind of bubbling and exploding in the past 5 years or so. And so certainly entropies, mutual informations, entanglement, quantum error correction, even communications protocols, those have all made appearances in the study of high energy physics, quantum gravity. Again, algorithms through simulation and complexity even is conjectured to be relevant to the structure of space and time. I have the third piece of the pie down below, which is actually how you would actually design a device to implement these things. And that is not really our concern, but of course, a lot of people work on this, and it's important. For this lecture, again, this is basics, and so I'm not going to be doing anything terribly sophisticated. We're going to start off just talking briefly about density operators, which I'm sure pretty much most of you have encountered before. But we're going to focus on the question of distinguishability. If you are studying quantum mechanics, the Hilbert space interproduct is everywhere, and to some extent you lose it once you go to mixed states. What's supposed to replace it? A basic observation called the Schmidt decomposition about the structure of entanglement for pure states, the structure of maps that send density operators to density operators, those are quantum channels, and finally we'll say a little bit about entropy. So subject number one, density operators. Again, I think pretty much everyone here has probably encountered them before, but in the interest of setting notation, if we have a pure state of a bipartite Hilbert space, so a tensor product Hilbert space, say HA tensor HB, we can construct its projector, which is an operator acting on A and B. And the density operator is what you get if you take the trace over the B degrees of freedom of that projector. And this is a useful thing, because if you were interested in the expectation value of some observable that acts only on the A system for the quantum state phi, we all know how to write down the expectation value of that observable. We'd write down phi OA tensored with the identity on B phi. And I'll use these little subscripts here to indicate what system the stator operator is attached to. And I should just indicate, I've already made use of an abusive notation that I will recur here. If I have a pure state, which is described by a ket, if I strip off the ket and just write the symbol, say phi in this case, I actually mean the density operator. So phi sub A is the A density operator for the state phi. So here's the expression for the expectation value of the observable, and you can check for yourselves that this can also be written as the trace of the observable against the reduced density operator phi A. And so if you want to be able to describe the outcomes of all possible measurements on the A system, it's sufficient to have a description of the density operator on A. You don't need the whole quantum state on the larger system. Which is, of course, very useful if you're trying to do open system physics. You don't want to have to talk, you know, explicitly describe your environment all the time. You only want to describe the system that you're actually interested in. So the things to know about the density operator, it's positive semi-definite, which I'll just write like that. Its eigenvalues are non-negative, and its trace is 1. All right, so everyone's on the same page. Now, it's actually very useful, conceptually, to think about what this actually looks like in the case of qubits. So if we have a two-dimensional system, then we can write the density operator of a two-dimensional system as 1/2 times the identity, because the trace is going to be equal to 1, times a vector r dot sigma, where sigma is the vector of Pauli operators, right? Because between the identity and the Pauli operators, we have a basis for the Hermitian matrices. The coefficient of the identity is fixed by the trace, and so these three parameters, the r's, are what's free, and of course, rj is just the trace of rho against sigma j. Right? It's the expectation value of sigma x, sigma y, or sigma z. And so you can then plot this thing. So we'll have the expectation value of sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. It's sometimes called the Bloch sphere. And the states that are described by Ketz have an expectation value of 1 for some linear combination of Pauli operators. Well, doesn't matter. The surface of the sphere consists of the states for which the rank is 1. Right? So these are called the pure states. So they're actually described by a single ket. So we'll call these pure. And the unit ball gives you all density operators. So the condition that the operator be positive semi-definite, in this case, just is the condition that the length of this vector is less than the vector r is less than or equal to 1. So this is a very simple picture, but it's quite useful. There's one point, you know, which is privileged, sitting at the center, which is the identity matrix, or rather the maximally mixed state. And what this picture, well, it does a lot of things for you. It tells you that the states live in a three-dimensional vector space, and so they transform under unitary transformations just by rotations of the sphere. But it also really makes manifest and clear the convex structure of the space of density operators. So density, if I take a mixture of two density operators, I get another density operator. And the way that happens on the sphere is just that you actually, you know, if you ask if I take a mixture of the state that has an expectation value sigma z plus 1, equal mixture with a state that has an expectation value sigma z minus 1, what am I going to get? I'm going to get the state lying exactly halfway between them, which is the maximally mixed state. And I just want to contrast this with a classical situation. Because this is actually a very basic point about quantum information, which is a little bit underappreciated. So suppose that I have a probability distribution on three different possibilities. So I can plot the probability of 0, the probability of 1, and the probability of 2. And each of those is between 0 and 1. And the allowed probability distributions, again, form a convex set, which is this simplex, right? A set of convex combinations of the points, this 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0. And in the case of a classical probability distribution, any state or any distribution that I choose, which is inside, can be written uniquely as a convex combination of the classical of the possibilities 0, 1, and 2. Right? But now look at the quantum mechanical situation. If I choose, say, that maximum mixed state in the middle again, it was an equal mixture of up and down. It's an equal mixture of left and right. It's an equal mixture of forward and backward. It's an equal mixture of states uniformly distributed over the entire sphere. If I choose this point up here, it's an equal mixture of, or it's a weighted mixture of up and down. It's also an equal mixture of points around that of states around that latitude. And so any density operator which is not pure has an infinite number of different ways of being described as a mixture of pure states. And so something very sort of fundamental about mixed quantum states is that there's ensemble ambiguity. And that is at the heart of, as you'll see, some of the difficulties in talking about entanglement for mixed states. It's also the reason that a number of quantum mechanical protocols are actually possible. We don't, you know, this isn't a cryptography course, but our inability to distinguish an equal mixture of up and down, an equal mixture of, say, left and right, is essentially why you can do things like quantum key distribution. That an eavesdropper can't tell things apart that somehow classically they would have been able to tell apart. So that's message number one, ensemble ambiguity. And as I said before, when you're doing quantum mechanics, the Hilbert space inner product is everywhere. But if we go to mixed states, what's supposed to replace it, right? This is kind of a basic starting point. And somehow, it's not as well known as it should be. So we'll just talk about distinguishability for a little bit. And that might not sound like a terribly exciting subject, but in fact, the theme of this entire lecture, I think, is going to be distinguishability of density operators. And that theme turns out to be a fairly generous theme that will encompass such things as entropy and free energy and lots of other stuff. So, distinguishability. There's not a unique choice for how you should talk about the distinguishability of mixed states. It depends to some extent on what your purpose is. But there are some functions that are tremendously useful for doing this. And the first one is called the fidelity function. And this is going to generalize the inner product to mixed states. So what do I mean by that? Well, I want to find a function that is 0 less than or equal to the fidelity between rho and sigma for two mixed states, less than or equal to 1. It's going to be 1, or equal to 1, if and only if rho equals sigma. It will be equal to 0 if and only if rho, I'll write rho perpendicular to sigma. So if you look at the non-zero eigenspace corresponding to rho, or for the rho density operator, and the non-zero eigenspace for the sigma density operator, if those two things are orthogonal, then there's a quantum measurement that will be able to tell you whether the state was rho or sigma. Right? So that's sort of the mixed state analog of being orthogonal. We can also write that as trace of rho sigma equals 0. So we want a function that has these properties. And we want it to reduce to the modulus of the inner product for pure states. So that's what we're looking for. And there's an easy way to construct such a function. F of rho sigma is going to be the maximum of the modulus of the inner product. It's a good starting point, since that's what we've wanted to generalize. For phi and psi in some tensor product Hilbert space, satisfying the condition that on A, the phi state is rho, and on A, the psi state is sigma. Okay? So the language that we would use here is that the state phi is a purification of rho, because rho is potentially a mixed state. And so we look for a pure state on a larger Hilbert space whose reduced density operator is rho, likewise for sigma and psi. And so we maximize the inner product over all purifications. Now you might ask, why do you maximize it rather than minimizing it? If you minimize it, you're always going to be able to make these things orthogonal. That's not interesting. So maximizing it gives you an actual honest-to-goodness measure of how close these states are to each other. And I'm just going to write out one last property. So this function is concave. Right? So what does that mean? It means that the fidelity of a mixture of density operators is at least as big as the average of the fidelities of the density operators. Right? So when you mix things together, you lose information. And so your ability to tell things apart should go down. And so this is a basic property of the fidelity function. Why am I telling you about this? If you're trying to do quantum information, I guess you already know. The inner product is very useful. But you often need to quantify. You know, you're going to be able to say in many circumstances that states are close. We need to know how close are they. What implication does that have for the evaluation of correlation functions for the performance of measurements? And the fidelity is a useful function in that regard. And what's particularly useful about the fidelity is really its definition, that it relates the distinguishability of mixed states to inner products on a larger Hilbert space. But the fidelity function has some defects. Yeah, from the perspective of actually sort of making arguments, one of which is that it doesn't sort of obviously follow from this definition that if rho is close to sigma and sigma is close to tau, that rho is close to tau, right? I mean, it's actually true, but it's not obvious. And so there's another function which plays a very important role in quantum information, which is called the trace distance. Yeah. Oh, no, it gets more explicit if you want. So this is the trace of the square root of rho to the 1/2 sigma rho to the 1/2. But that's kind of an ugly looking formula. but you can show that that's the same thing. I can tell you that this is much more useful than that. So the trace distance, this thing is actually going to be a metric on the set of mixed states. And to talk about the trace distance, I just have to remind you of one of the most basic facts of linear algebra, which you may or may not be familiar with, strangely enough. So if you have any matrix, and I really mean any matrix, it doesn't even have to be square, right? It can be a rectangular matrix. You can always write it as x is equal to u dv. It's called the singular value decomposition. So u and v are unitary, and d is diagonal. So with entries, say, d1, d2, down to dn. And not only is it diagonal, those diagonal entries are non-negative. So again, you know, in physics, we almost always encounter operators that can be diagonalized, Hermitian operators, unitary operators, and such. And so somehow the singular value decomposition doesn't play such a big role. But if you ever do any data analysis or statistics, you have no doubt encountered the singular value decomposition. And it's extremely useful. And it's going to be useful for us for defining a norm on matrices. And other things. So just out of curiosity, who is familiar with the singular value decomposition? Most of you, good, excellent. But not everybody. Okay, so I'm going to define a norm on matrices. So norm symbol and a little one in the lower right. So these, the language here, this is the Shatten L1 norm, if you care to look these things up. But this is just going to be the sum of those singular values, right? So otherwise known as the trace of D. This is why this is called the trace distance. It's just the trace. And if you want another formula, trace of X dagger X, square root. So the L2 norm of the matrix would have been the square root of the trace of X dagger X. So the difference is that we moved the square root inside. And our trace distance now is just going to be the natural metric that you get from using this Shatten L1 norm, this trace norm, like so. So this might look pretty arbitrary to you, right? There are an infinity of different norms that you can put on matrices, but I'm going to tell you at the moment, and we'll see for a little bit why in just a little bit, this is the right one. And in fact, I'll even tell you that on your problem set this afternoon, you'll get pretty close to seeing why this is the right one. That if you wanted to try to distinguish rho and sigma, say there were, someone gave you rho and sigma, each with probability a half, and you wanted to figure out, did they actually give you rho or did they give you sigma? Your probability of error is a function of t. Right? You can write it in terms of t. And I don't actually ask you to show that on the problem set, but it's only two lines beyond something you do, so you can prove that to yourself if you want. All right. So again, what kind of properties does this have? Zero is less than or equal to t, is less than or equal to 2. And of course, at 0, if and only if rho equals sigma. And it's 2 if and only if rho can be perfectly distinguished from sigma. And this thing, because we've defined it using a norm, satisfies the triangle inequality. And in addition, it's convex, right? That's another consequence of the triangle inequality. So again, for the fidelity function, we want it to be concave because we wanted mixing to reduce distinguishability. And for the same reason, we want this trace distance to be convex. Because we want when we mix for this distance to actually go down. So it should go this way. All right, so those are the basic functions of distinguishability. That again, you really just need to know if you want to actually do quantum information. Now you might be, the last fact about these that I want to tell you about for the moment before we'll come back to them later and use them for something. So we now have fidelity, and we have trace distance. And it just looks like these are two independent ways of measuring the distance between two density operators. And they aren't functions of each other, so they're independent in that sense, but they can't be that different. 1 minus the fidelity is less than or equal to half the trace distance, is less than or equal to the square root of 1 minus the fidelity squared. So that's something you can prove. But the important thing about these inequalities is that nowhere does the dimension of the Hilbert space come in here, right? So that if you're close in fidelity sense, then you're always close in trace distance sense. If you're far in fidelity sense, you're always far in trace distance sense. So these things are morally equivalent. No dimensional factors. So that T is pretty much equivalent to F. And we just go back and forth between the two. We use the fidelity if it's convenient, if we want to make use of this definition in terms of a larger Hilbert space, which is often very helpful. And in particular, this fact, I suspect either during my Shannon theory lecture or during Dan Harlow's talk on information retrieval from black holes, this fact, somehow this part of the definition becomes very crucial for being able to argue that a recovery map exists for quantum information, or for information that you're trying to recover from Hawking radiation. And then, of course, the usual metric properties are useful for the trace distance. So you can just go back and forth. Yeah?
So are these particularly quantum, or are they just...
Oh, good question. So They're generalizations of classical quantities. So I think this thing, if you just take, so another way to write this, now that we've defined this Chatenel 1 norm, is the Chatenel 1 norm of square root of rho times square root of sigma. And so in this form, if rho and sigma commuted, then it would be the sum of the square roots of the probabilities associated with rho and sigma. And that thing, I think, is called the Bhattacharya measure, I think, in classical statistics. And this, in the case of probabilities, would be the sum of the differences of probabilities for different events, absolute value. And that's called the variational distance, and this is the basic measure in statistics of how close two distributions are. So, yeah, they're generalizations. Yeah? I'm sorry, I couldn't. Oh, yes. I should have mentioned that. I didn't mention it for a reason, which is that on the problem set, the students will see how this is related to the expectation values of observables. But I can just write it on the board, since McCun will probably not be in the problem session. So T of rho sigma is equal to the maximum over observables. These eigenvalues are bounded by 1 of the trace of O rho minus sigma. Right, so it really is measures how well you can distinguish rho from sigma using an observable. Yeah. Okay. So that's actually all I want to tell you for the moment about distance measures, but there's more to the story. The most important part of the story is still coming up. But since we've introduced the singular value decomposition, it's worth actually taking the time to write down its most important use in quantum information. And that's something called the Schmidt decomposition. And in fact, the Schmidt decomposition is just another name for the singular value decomposition. It has a name in the particular context we're going to use it, but it's really just the Schmidt decomposition. So suppose that you're given, again, a quantum state on the tensor product of two Hilbert spaces. So this is potentially an entangled state. You know, generically, it's an entangled state. And you want to figure out, you know, what is the basic data that describes the entanglement in that state. Now, if you write, you know, if you just choose a basis and write down the expansion of your quantum state, these coefficients, alpha ij, on the face of it, don't really obviously tell you much about how entangled the state is. Right? You might have thought, well, if a lot of the coefficients are non-negative, then that state has to be entangled, but that's not true. You can have all of these coefficients be occupied and still have a product state. But what you can do is you can think of alpha as a matrix. Let's go over here. So the matrix alpha, we can apply the singular value decomposition to it and write it as UDV. And if we do that, then this expression here becomes a sum over I, j, and k of UIK, the diagonal matrix, VKJ, IJ. Right, so we just expanded, used the singular value decomposition. And then I can just absorb, you know, I can actually multiply, I can rewrite this as DKK and some new states, EK and FK. Right? And these new states will satisfy the property that they're orthonormal. So why are they orthonormal? Well, because U and V are unitary matrices. And so if you act on an orthonormal set of states by a unitary matrix, you get a new orthonormal set of states. But this expression for my general quantum state phi now has a much nicer, much nicer form. In fact, in this form, there's a clear symmetry between the A Hilbert space and the B Hilbert space, right? That aside from the fact that, you know, the EK vectors may not be the same as the FK vectors, you know, they're related unitarily if these are isomorphic Hilbert spaces, the sort of the content which describes the basic properties of the state is symmetric between left and right. So this implies, for example, if we go to calculate the reduced density operator, the reduced density operator is sum over k dkk ek squared. So from the Schmidt decomposition, you can just read off the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the reduced density operator. And these Schmidt coefficients really are telling you everything there is to know about the entanglement of this quantum state AB. They're unitary invariants, which you can check for yourself, or local unitary invariants. And it also implies, sort of obviously, that the non-zero eigenvalues of phi A are the same as the non-zero eigenvalues of phi B. And I write the non-zero ones because you may not have noticed, but we made use of the full strength of the singular value decomposition here, which is that this works for any matrix, right? That if the B Hilbert space, for example, was much larger than the A Hilbert space, then this matrix alpha is not, or doesn't have to be much larger, the matrix alpha doesn't have to be square, right? Which means that when you look at this matrix D, it will have a bunch of zeros in addition to the non-negative or the positive numbers. And again, the Schmidt decomposition, on the face of it, I mean, at the moment I want to have a punchline in this lecture, but I do want to show you just the basic facts that get used all the time in quantum information. And when you have bipartite pure entangled states, the Schmidt decomposition is everywhere. And so now you know where it comes from. It's an easy thing to prove if you know the singular value decomposition. Are there questions about Schmidt? Again, at the moment it feels like a dry fact. In your problem set this afternoon, you will use the Schmidt decomposition to show that a basic primitive of distributed computation called bit commitment is impossible in quantum mechanics. And in doing so, you will actually be showing, well, there was a pretty famous paper in the 1990s that claimed to show that bit commitment could be realized using quantum mechanics. Turned out it was wrong because people didn't actually properly understand the Schmidt decomposition. So you'll see why. Yeah. Yeah, because so U and V are unitary, so they're always square. But yeah, D has the same dimensions as X. So we could say that this is the sum over the non-zeros. Other questions? You're good. Okay. So that's all static stuff. Now let's talk a little bit about sort of open system evolution. Like what can happen to density operators? And again, this is the sort of basic formalism that you need before you can actually start doing quantum information. So, channels. So let's start out with a classical case. So in the classical setting, I would have some variable. And that variable is going to be transformed by some noisy system, you know, input into output. So what would be a good model? Actually, I'll try to involve you now. What would be a good model of a transformation of an input variable to an output variable in a noisy setting? So I have some input variable, some output variable, x goes to y. How will x and y be related to each other? How about this? I just have a list of conditional probability distributions. If the input is x, then I stochastically produce y, right? Where there's some probability distribution, p of y given x. So this is actually, in classical information theory, when people say a channel, this is what they mean, right? It's just a stochastic map from input to output. And I'm gonna tell you, or we're gonna discuss, what the quantum mechanical analog of this object is. So in the quantum case, I'm going to have some input density operator rho, and I'll write the channel n for noise, and out is going to come n of rho. And the question is, well, how should I model this transformation? And a physically motivated way of modeling this transformation is say, well, what could actually happen physically to this density operator rho? Maybe I could take rho, and I would bring it in contact with another physical system, and then I'd allow those two systems to interact unitarily, and then I might discard some degrees of freedom. Right? That might be some special example of a noisy process that would generate an n of rho given a rho. Right? So one particular picture would be that I have rho come in, and then I'll just write it as zero. So I just have some particular quantum state of some other degrees of freedom. I allow those to interact unitarily. And then I'll put a little trash bin here. So I discard some of the degrees of freedom, and out comes n of rho. And I'll put some labels on these systems here. Maybe the input will be called A, the output will be called B. The thing I discard, I'll call it E for environment. And just to be general here, I'll call this other system that we brought in contact the F system. So this is certainly something that can happen to a quantum system. And this generates some linear transformation of rho to the output. And it certainly takes density operators to density operators by construction. So let's just do a little calculation. So n of rho, let's just unpack this. I take the trace over E of some unitary acting on rho tensored with a zero state, u dagger. And I'm going to expand the trace. So I could write this as the sum over some orthonormal basis for the environment system of u, rho tensor 0, u dagger 0. And there's an f there. And I'm going to take, here I have a bra, so the u acts on both A and E, or A and F, right? And these kets and bras only act on parts of the system. So I can rewrite this as sum over j. I'll say n sub j, rho n sub j dagger, where n sub j is 0, or sorry, j, u. Oh, yes, thank you. Yeah. So this is just a more compact way of writing this trace, right? But it's also kind of, it's more intrinsic, because it tells me what happens to the density operator rho entirely in terms of matrices that take the input system A to the output system B without any reference to the ancilla that I brought into contact with A, and the environment that I traced over. So this is a more intrinsic description of what a channel would be. And we can verify that for all rho, the trace of rho, by construction, is the trace of n of rho. Right? We take density operators to density operators, so we can't change the trace. And this thing is the sum over j of the trace nj rho nj dagger, which is the trace of the sum over j nj dagger nj rho. And so if this equation is going to be true for all rho, then this object inside the parentheses has to just be the identity matrix, right? So this implies that sum over j, nj dagger, nj is the identity. And this actually gives us an alternate definition of a quantum channel. That if you have any set of matrices, no other conditions on them, other than this normalization condition, and you write down a map of this form, that gives me a quantum channel. And as an exercise, if you want to, you can construct this representation in terms of a unitary and larger systems from this data. So we'll say this is an alternate definition. Of what it means to be a quantum channel. And we don't have time to go into it, but there's a more abstract way of thinking about this, which is just to say, well, suppose that I wanted to think about maps that took density operators to density operators and were consistent with the probabilistic interpretation of rho when I do measurements, right? Which actually pretty much requires that n be linear. So if I have a linear map that takes density operators to density operators in a strong sense, you can prove that all such maps have this form. And all such maps, can be represented as bring rho in contact with an ancilla system, evolve unitarily, and then take this partial trace. So that's a theorem. And I'll just write down the symbols, as you'll hear this language elsewhere. So the class of all such maps are the completely positive trace-preserving maps. Completely positive means you preserve the positive semi-definiteness of the density operator. Trace-preserving, you don't lose probability. And again, in your problem set, you will see some of the subtleties, the difference between what's called a completely positive and a positive map. And that's useful for doing things like detecting entanglement. And as just a brief aside, this is kind of extremely natural and intuitive from the physical perspective, right? Like this class of channels that I wrote down, this is sort of the if I asked you if someone asked you to write down a noisy evolution of a quantum system, you'd probably write something, a picture like this down, right? But this relationship between completely positive maps and these, what's called a Steinspring representation of this type, was first discovered in representation theory, when people were writing down sort of maps on characters of representations, and they noticed certain patterns. And there, it was a pretty mysterious thing. But in the physical context, it's very natural. I didn't quite hear that, but the dimension, so nj is not necessarily square. It's a linear transformation from A to B. Is that a...
I'm thinking of the dimension of the Hilbert space of an ancilla, and the dimension of the Hilbert space of the environment.
Yes, okay, good question. So here I haven't said anything about how big the environment needs to be. And you have to do a little bit of work, but if the, so let's say that A and B have the same dimension, because I don't remember exactly how it works when they don't, but it's similar. So if A and B have the same dimension, call it D, then the environment has to have size D squared in the worst case. And so this is actually sort of physically interesting, that maybe you had a qubit, a spin that was interacting with a bath of oscillators. So you have some infinite dimensional environment. The transformation that induces can always be represented as a qubit interacting with two qubits. I mean, the physics might not be well represented if you want to actually write down a Hamiltonian or some continuous time evolution. But as an instantaneous description of input to output, you can always do it with a d squared or a two-qubit environment. Yeah?
In the classical case, is there a relationship between these conditional probabilities and the N matrix? Or?
So we can think of the classical case as being a special case of the quantum, where all of the density operators are diagonal in some fixed basis. And then these NJ matrices are, in fact, diagonal matrices. And the, you know, the condition, you know, the diagonal entries are these conditional probabilities, and we, you know, we have just these conditions that they're non-negative, and the sum over y of p of y given x is equal to 1. And so that gives you a special subclass of these quantum transformations. I see what you mean, yeah. NJ is pretty much a square root of these things. Yeah. Yep.
Is it true that when you assume that this quantum system rho interacts with some other system, that you are making the very special assumption that it starts off not being entangled, but it's a product?
Yes. No. So
interactions, this might not work at all because there are already interactions.
Yeah. So in this picture, as you say, we're assuming that rho is completely independent of the input on the environment. And if you're actually trying to write down some open system evolution, you know, you have a system that's interacting with the environment, you might develop some correlations, and those might come back to bite you at some later time in the future. And so that's an assumption which is required for this to work. If you take the more abstract point of view, which is that N is just a linear transformation from input to output, and you have to preserve the complete positivity, you're not injecting this Markovian assumption at the outset, but it's somehow implicit in the fact that this is actually just a function of rho, right? That if you're trying to describe open system evolution, but the correlations were important, then you would not need not just rho, but a description of how rho is correlated with the environment. Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. Yeah, exactly. You might as well just absorb the purification of a mixed environment into the, you know, just throw in everything to the environment that you want. At least formally, F can just be rest of universe. So now that we have this notion of quantum channel, I want to tell you something, an additional property of these distance measures, which is really crucially important. So I'll call this monotonicity. So if you have a measure of distinguishability, like the fidelity or the trace distance, what do you think should happen under the action of a noisy channel? Should it go up or go down? Should you become more distinguishable or less distinguishable? Who thinks less? Excellent intuition. That is correct. Right, so f of rho sigma, so this is a measure of non-distinguishability. This should go up if you act by a noisy channel. That's always true for any rho and sigma and quantum channels n. And likewise, the trace distance should go down. Because it actually is a bona fide measure of distinguishability. Now this property, right? So the other properties that I wrote down before for the, you know, for these measures, you could have written down an infinity of different norms, right? All those Schatten LP norms would have sort of had reasonable properties. You know, they would have been zero if and only if rho is equal to orthogonal to sigma or equal to sigma and so on. But this monotonicity is very special, and so I'm. the only one of those Chatton LP norms that will actually satisfy monotonicity for all channels and states is this one, right? Is the trace distance. And so this requirement that you not increase distinguishability, this monotonicity, really singles out a particular measure as being the one that is actually physically relevant. In particular, you know, like anyone who talks about norms on matrices, the most natural thing to write down is L2, right? It's easy to calculate, but L2 does not have this monotonicity property, right? The Hilbert-Schmidt norm. And so it's not a good way to measure how close density operators are. Or at least you could, you know, maybe you can use it as an intermediate step sometimes, but you shouldn't trust your answer until you relate it to the trace norm. And just a preview before we get to the end, we're going to introduce one final measure of distinguishability, and this monotonicity property is going to encode all of these things that you've heard of, like strong subadditivity of the entropy in that case. But before we get there, because yes, but I'd have to, I actually don't have it, you know, on the top of my head. I'll construct one for you today and I'll tell you.
Patrick, was the claim that this was the only one over the Schutten norms, or is this the really unique overall norm, overall matrix?
I believe it's unique. Possibly, I have to check zero and infinity might have, some, you know, may also work, but not be very interesting. But it, you know, it's at the very least very, very special. Yeah.
So, I have a question. So, does this also mean that you try to use something like L1, L2 inequality to replace the trace distance with some multiple of the two norms? You can't sandwich that?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, there are lots of inequalities relating different LP norms. You know, there's LP duality, there's, you know, Holder's inequality, all kinds of other stuff. And if you bound some, you know, the distance between some density operators and some other norm, you know, if you can produce a useful inequality that gets you back to the trace norm, then you'll get some intuition, then you'll get some sense of how strong the thing you proved actually is, right, in terms of the actual distinguishability of density operators. I'm not sure that I fully understand the question. I mean, the basic idea, I mean, you can do whatever you want mathematically, right? You can write down any norms that are easy to calculate, easy to bound, but you shouldn't trust your conclusions until the quantity you've written down about how close to density operators are can be related to the, for example, is it still up here? Yeah. Yeah, the how close expectation values of observables are going to be when you perform measurements, right? And it's the trace distance that does that for you. And until you've gotten to that point, you know, you've just actually, you know, it's just a sort of mathematical manipulation that may not have physical relevance. Yeah.
So you said the trace norm is uniquely satisfies the monotonicity. Is there some uniqueness about the fidelity? I guess that's not a norm or something, or
Is there some uniqueness? There are other functions that you can define there, and there is a uniqueness statement, I believe. So you can extend the fidelity function to non-normalized positive semi-definite operators, and it turns out the fidelity has some property called double concavity, and it is the unique extension of the modulus of the inner product to non-normalized density operators that is doubly concave. And so doubly concave is some slightly stronger, you know, it's slightly stronger than monotonicity. Other questions? Okay, let's see, how much time do we have here? I think we have enough. So I actually, since I've sort of just been listing properties for you, I want to give you a little illustration of how these tools are used in quantum information. And at the same time, maybe demystify some language that quantum information theorists use. So you'll often hear a quantum information theorist say, send some quantum information from Alice to Bob. And you might not know really what they mean by that. So send quantum information. It sounds very very poorly defined. And it is kind of a poorly defined concept. But one of the reasons we can get away with a poorly defined concept is because lots of different ways of defining the same thing actually end up being pretty much equivalent. And so I'll define something precise. Suppose we can send some entanglement. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. So we have some entangled quantum state, psi AR, so entangled between A and R. I'm writing R. R is going to stand for reference. And we have a quantum channel, N. So, and we know that the fidelity of psi with the channel tensored with the identity on the reference acting on psi is greater than 1 minus epsilon. Okay, so as a picture, we have some entangled state psi. We have A, we have the reference, we have a noisy channel. And now I'm going to say it's sort of epsilon close to having done nothing. So this is what I'm going to mean by we're able to send the, you know, the entanglement of the quantum state psi through the channel. Right? We take one half of that quantum state, we send it through the channel, and what comes out, in the fidelity sense, is close to what we started with, so that the channel doesn't destroy that entanglement. So that's one notion of what it might mean to send quantum information through the channel. And of course, the more entangled the state psi is, the better this ability to transmit, presumably. But there are other notions. You know, I might have meant something else when I said I can send quantum, send quantum information through the channel. That you might have thought if I had said, well, if I can send quantum information through the channel, what that means is that there's a whole family of quantum states, and if I send them through the channel, they go through the channel unmolested, right? They, what comes out is the same as what went in. Whereas this, this property is just saying for a very specific state, psi AR, the channel does not do damage, right? So that seems like it seems potentially like a weaker notion, right? As opposed to saying for a whole family of states, the channel actually doesn't damage the quantum information, or doesn't damage the state. So, I guess I for well, let's use so let's define another channel. So, channel D. So, D. Oh, well, D is going to be a channel that acts on the reference system. So D of some state on the reference system. It's going to be sum over j, rho r, j. So what does that do? In this j basis, which I'm assuming those j's are orthonormal now, it just sets all the off-diagonal entries to 0, right? So it just takes the density operator and gives us back the diagonal entries. That's the full story. And now let's think about the fidelity of psi with n tensor d of psi. So can anyone tell me anything about that fidelity? Is it high? Is it low? So if I decohere, what I'm really doing, D stands for decoherence. If I decohere the reference, how does that affect the fidelity? Try again. Increase. So a quantum channel has to decrease distinguishability which means it has to increase fidelity, right? Because the states have to get closer together. So this is at least as big as the fidelity of psi AR, n tensor the identity on the reference, psi, by monotonicity, which we know is at least 1 minus epsilon. Right? And now let's calculate. So n tensor d acting on psi. Well, maybe I'll leave this as an exercise to you. Just some simple linear algebra with a bunch of delta functions. Oh, I'm sorry. I need to make another assumption. So we can always write psi AR, right, in terms of this basis of the reference, right? So it's going to have the form sum over j, and I'll write square root pj, phi j, j. Right? So if I take some basis for the reference, then there's always some set of unnormalized states on A, such that I can write this. But the phi j's might be, as I say, unnormalized, or phi j's are normalized, but they might have to have some normalization constant out front, and they might not be orthogonal to each other. Right? When we did the Schmidt decomposition, we found that there was a specific basis of the reference system such that the A states would be orthonormal, right? But in general, that doesn't need to be true. All we know in general is that we can do this. So these guys, not orthogonal in general. And so now if we actually calculate what happens when we decohere the reference, we're not doing a Schmidt decomposition because the Schmidt decomposition only holds in one particular orthonormal frame of the reference. So I'm just saying choose some arbitrary orthonormal basis, right? And if you choose an arbitrary orthonormal basis, then you just have some set of states on A. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm not going to do the calculation. I'll leave it to you. But I'll ask you, what do you think should happen if I decohere the reference? What should the output look like? Or suppose that I decohered the input. What would I get? If I decohere the input, then this superposition becomes a mixture of phi j's with probabilities pj. And then I apply the channel, n, and what comes out, each of those phi j's undergo the quantum evolution. Right? So this thing is going to be sum over j, pj, n of phi j, tensor j. And one last thing I should tell you about fidelity. So the fidelity of an arbitrary pure state with a mixed state has another simple formula, which is a special case of the more general one that I wrote down before. It looks like that. All right, so the most natural thing you could do, given a bra and a density operator, would be to calculate this thing that looks like an expectation value. And because it's the modulus of the inner product and not the modulus of the inner product squared, we sort of have two powers of an inner product here. We should take a square root. So that's what fidelity is actually equal to. And so if I calculate fidelity squared, so now we know that 1 minus epsilon squared is less than or equal to the fidelity of psi n tensor d psi squared, which is going to be the sum over j pj phi j, n of phi j, phi j. So I'm skipping some simple steps there, but right, so we now have this expression for the fidelity in the case where one of the states is pure. So we'll just apply it, and we get rid of the square root because I took the square. And what we get when we do the calculation is just the average of these squared fidelities between the input and the output for those particular states. And, oh, and there's a square here. So a probability squared is non-negative and less than or equal to 1. This thing that looks like an expectation value, it's like the expectation value of a positive semi-definite operator whose eigenvalues are between 0 and 1. So that's less than or equal to 1. So we can take the square root, and it's only going to go up. So sum over j, pj, the fidelity of phi j against n of phi j. Right? Because again, this looks like the fidelity of phi j against the output, because phi j is pure, has this form. And so what we've seen is that the average fidelity of these states phi j when they're sent through the channel is at least 1 minus epsilon squared. Right? And of course, 1 minus epsilon squared is at least 1 minus 2 epsilon. So if you know that the quantum channel sends a single entangled state, or that you can send a single entangled state through the channel effectively, then just using these monotonicity properties and some simple calculations, what you learn is you can send an entire ensemble of pure states through the channel such that the fidelity on average is high. And in fact, you can do better than what I've done on the board here, and I'll leave it as an exercise to you. If you have any convex decomposition of the density operator psi a, you can get this argument to work. So if you have a single entangled state that purifies, well, maybe I'll write it down so you can actually do it as an exercise if you're so inclined. So given that psi ar n tensored with the identity psi ar is at least 1 minus epsilon, the following is true. So for all decompositions of psi a as a mixture with probabilities qj of some states cj, the average fidelity for those cj states is at least 1 minus 2 epsilon. So it just requires a little bit more work than what we've done here today, or done so far. And so if you can send a single entangled state, you can send all kinds of different, you know, any representation of the density operator on A in terms of a mixture of pure states. On average, those will go through the state, through the channel effect, you know, with a little degradation. Yeah? Do we have to renormalize? It will be trace one. So, evaluate the trace and the basis J. Yeah. Again, like as a matrix, what this does in the basis of J's is it sets all the off diagonal entries to zero and keeps the diagonal entries. So since the trace is just the sum of the diagonals, this thing preserves the trace. I had meant to show you some examples of quantum channels, but maybe I'll do that at the end. This is sort of a canonical example because this is a kind of process that occurs physically all the time, right? Decoherence just kills off diagonal entries of density matrices. Yeah. I have a problem.
Yeah, second line in the middle board.
This one?
Second to third. You haven't applied D to the psi AR, right? You use monotonicity. The calculation will at the end be the same, but I think you...
Let's see. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. No, I forgot to write that. Thanks, John. So what I should have written here is the identity tensor D acting on psi, which will give the same answer, as he says. But to apply monotonicity, you need D acting on both arguments, not just the one on the left. OK, so we have just a few minutes left. And in those few minutes, since this is quantum information basics, we should talk about entropy. So the von Neumann entropy, again, I think this is one of those functions that most of the students in the audience, if not all of them, have encountered before, so I'll be a little bit quick about it. But it's defined as minus the trace of rho log rho, which you can write as minus the sum of the eigenvalues of rho minus lambda, you know, sum over lambda, lambda log lambda. And if some of the eigenvalues happen to be 0, we define 0 log 0 to be 0. So this function, it measures uncertainty, right? You're a physicist. You're very familiar with entropy. It's a measure of uncertainty. And what does that mean to be a measure of uncertainty? Well, it's non-negative. And we have equality if and only if the rank of rho is 1, right? If and only if it's a pure state. So that is some indication that this is a measure of uncertainty. And it's bounded above by the log of the dimension of the Hilbert space. And there you have equality if and only if rho is proportional to the to the identity operator. Right? So, being proportional to the identity operator is the most mixed possible, or is as mixed as you can possibly be for a density operator. So it's supposed to be a measure of uncertainty, and I've been listing sort of basic properties, you know, that that measures of things should have. How do you feel about the relationship between the sum over j? Pj for some probabilities. Let's call them sigmas just so that things look a little bit different. Versus sum over j pj s of sigma j. So if I ask about the entropy of a mixture versus the average of the entropies of the states in the mixture, do you think there should be some relationship between these things? Who thinks that we should have a less than or equal to? Who thinks we should have a greater than? Oh, OK, thank you for your courage. Who thinks we should have a greater than or equal to? A smattering. We should actually have a greater than or equal to here, right? So if you have a measure of uncertainty, think about some examples. Suppose the sigma j's were pure states, so their entropy is 0. Once you mix them together, you have a state whose eigenvalue, you know, that's no longer rank 1, so the entropy goes up. And intuitively, this is supposed to be a measure of uncertainty. So the more you mix stuff together, the more the uncertainty should go up. And so this is the the inequality that we have. And of course, this is concavity. That's the basic property of entropy. And I think at the moment, that's about as much as I want to tell you, because the other, the better properties of entropy, we derive them from a sort of master quantity, which is not entropy. But I'll just introduce some notation that I'll also write this. The entropy of the A system for the state rho, by definition, is the entropy of rho sub A. Right? So I might have a density operator that's defined on many different subsystems, on A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And if I write SA of rho, I mean the entropy of the A reduced density operator. So that's going to be sort of handy. So the more interesting properties of entropy, you can derive them and many other things from the properties of another function called the relative entropy. And, as I said, the theme of this lecture is distinguishability. The relative entropy is a measure of the distinguishability of two states. So the relative entropy, we write it S of rho double bar sigma, is defined to be the trace of rho log rho minus the trace of rho log sigma. And this is a measure of distinguishability, so you can prove this thing is bounded below by zero, and it's equal to zero if and only, so equal if and only if rho equals sigma. So far, so good, right? This is just like the trace distance. But the trace distance, one of its properties, it was bounded above by one, right? So it could never get all that big. And so even if you had, if you're looking at the trace distance between, two different states of our galaxy, it is only ever at most two, if those two states are orthogonal. The relative entropy is different. It can actually get as large, well, it can be infinite. And one of the cases where it's infinite is if, let's see, I'll call the support of rho is not contained in the support of sigma. All right, so if you look at the non-zero eigenspace of rho, if it is not contained in the non-zero eigenspace of sigma, then you have a positive number times the log of zero, right? And that thing blows up. So this quantity has the potential to get very large. And that might seem like a problem, because in particular, if you have two pure states that are not the same, this thing's infinite, right? So that's not terribly useful, or it would seem. But the way it gets big is often controlled in an interesting way. And what else should we say? Well, I'll just write down, of course, since this is a physical measure of distinguishability, it satisfies monotonicity. Distinguishability goes down. So there's the monotonicity statement. So this might seem like an exotic function. You've encountered entropy before. You may or may not have ever encountered relative entropy. You might look at it and say, well, who cares about relative entropy? That's just some weirdo thing that mathematicians came up with. Well, it's everywhere. So let's consider an example. So let's define the state sigma beta is a thermal state for some Hamiltonian at temperature, inverse temperature beta. Right? And let's just evaluate the relative entropy. For a state rho against this thermal state. So what are we going to get? We'll get the trace of rho log rho. Minus the trace of rho log e to the minus beta h over z. So the first term is just minus the entropy of rho. Great. So the second term, we take the log of the exponential, so we just get minus beta h. The minus signs cancel, so we get plus beta, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian for the state rho. Right? It's the average energy. And then we get plus log z. Right? So the log of the partition function. So we can rewrite this as beta times the free energy of rho minus the free energy of sigma beta, where the free energy, this is the Helmholtz free energy, U minus TS. Right? So a special case of relative entropy is this quantity that all physicists know and love, which is free energy. Right? So from this perspective, free energy differences are just measures of the distinguishability of two states, in particular, the distinguishability of a state from the thermal, state. So I don't have time to go through the full story of relative entropy, but I'll give you another greatest hit. So the what's called the mutual information. So the mutual information, if we wanted to, you know, so the symbol for it is I A semicolon B for rho. So this is a measure of the correlation of the state rho for two subsystems A and B that are non-overlapping. And we'll just define it to be the relative entropy of the density operator rho on AB with the product density operator. Right? So if we want to measure correlations, if the state actually is product and has no correlations in it, then we're going to get zero. And if there are any correlations at all, the relative entropy is going to be strictly positive. So again, if you, you know, as physicists, you're probably used to calculating correlators. And some correlators might be really small or zero, but generally that's not, that doesn't tell you whether the whole state has some correlation in it. But if you can evaluate mutual information, and you find that that it's zero, that is the conclusive test that the state is a product state. And in your problem set, you're going to actually evaluate this thing, so I won't do it here, but if you plug into the relative entropy formula, what you get is the entropy of A plus the entropy of B minus the joint entropy for A and B. And so this is actually quite nice and surprising, right? That if you want to determine whether a state has any correlations in it, right, that seems like a very complicated kind of question. In fact, all you have to do is evaluate three entropies. And if the sum of the entropies of the small systems is equal to the entropy of the joint system, that is the test for whether the state is correlated or not. Well, rho could actually be a state of a larger system. Often will be. So I'm just, I'm hedging. Okay. So what do we know about relative entropy? Well, we also have this monotonicity property, right? So what does it tell us in this case? So monotonicity tells us that if I look at the mutual information for a state rho between A and B, that should be larger than the mutual information if I act on rho by a pair of channels. Right, so if I have a channel N1 that acts on the A system, and maybe it takes A and it gives me back A prime, some different, you know, a state acting on different Hilbert space, and I have N2 that acts on the B system and gives me a state on B prime, then the monotonicity statement tells me that relative entropy can't increase, right? Which means mutual information has to go down. And you might have asked, well, wait, why do you have to look at this funny, you know, look at this special kind of channel, right? And the reason is that we need to be able to apply the channel to both the left argument and the right argument, as John, you know, reminded me up above. And if we had a channel that mixed A and B together in some non-trivial way, then we wouldn't know what to write on the right-hand side. But this is sort of the defining, or one of the, you know, the defining properties of a measure of correlation, right? That if you have a measure of the correlation between A and B, you should not be able to make it go up by acting on one of the systems locally. So the monotonicity statement for relative entropy tells you, you know, one of its implications is that mutual information is a good way to measure correlations, not just in the sense that it's zero if and only if the state is product, but in the sense that it cannot increase by local actions. And I think I'm running out of time, which is a good thing, because I just have one last little bit to tell you, which is a special case. So if I have a mutual information of three subsystems, A with BC, one channel, or you know, one thing that I could do is say that N1, my N1 channel is the identity, and N2 is the partial trace over C. So my monotonicity tells me that I can't increase the mutual information by throwing away one of my subsystems. And if you look at the definition of mutual information, well, the left-hand side and the right-hand side will both have an entropy of A, and those cancel. And what's left is the entropy of AB plus the entropy of BC is at least the entropy of ABC plus the entropy of B. And this is the famous property known as the strong subadditivity of the entropy function. And again, we don't have time. I might say a bit more in the quantum Shannon theory lectures. Some of the other lecturers might tell you additional properties about the entropy function. But pretty much anything interesting that you want to know about quantum entropy is in this function. And in fact, this is the only non-trivial inequality that is known to hold for the quantum entropy function. Everything else is sort of a consequence of this. And it's not, you know, for classical mutual information, this is an easy thing to prove. Any property of classical mutual information that you really care about is just a consequence of the convexity of the log function. To prove this, the initial proof, this was a conjecture back in the 70s, eventually proved by Lieb and Ruskai using methods from complex analysis, maximum modulus principle. It was subsequently proved, you know, by some aggressive brute force linear algebra. It can be proved by sort of coding theory methods. There are lots of different, lots of different methods. One method that I particularly like, it can be proved using representation theory of the symmetric and unitary groups. And so one of the school participants, he's probably in the relativity lecture, Michael Walter, is responsible for that proof. So if you want to know how to prove strong subadditivity using representation theory, find Michael. One way you can't prove it, I'll just mention, is through holography. So Matt Hedrick has this beautiful demonstration that in ADS-CFT, if you assume the Ryu-Takinagi formula, then you can easily derive this inequality, a beautiful argument. But that's not a proof of strong subadditivity in general. It's a proof of strong subadditivity for the states for which Ryu-Takinagi applies. But strong subadditivity is a general property that holds for all quantum states. And with that, I think I'm out of time, so thanks for your attention. I would even say that you should. So the question was, can you define thermalization in terms of the trace distance? And I think a very natural way to define thermalization, if you want a strong notion of thermalization, is to say that the physical process that you're looking at produces a state which is close in trace distance to the thermal state. And if you do that, then that means that for any measurement that you would perform on the system, the expectation values are going to be close to their thermal values. Although one caveat would be that in a practical sense, that might be asking more than you really care about, which is that when people think about thermalization, in practice, they're often thinking about a subset of observables, and they're asking when does that subset of observables relax? And so a more general concept would be to say that you have, say, a subalgebra of observables, and you talk about a state only on that subalgebra. And then you ask, at what point does the state on that subalgebra in trace distance become close to its thermal value? And I think that would maybe be, in a practical sense, a good way to define thermalization.
OK, thank you. Matt, last question.
So
So the original Lieb-Ruskai proof was a proof of strong subadditivity. I think it was Ullmann who proved the monotonicity of relative entropy. And you know, they eventually realized back in the 70s that you could get strong subadditivity from that. These days, so there's actually, in the past year and a half or so, there's been a lot of really exciting developments. So this is an inequality here. But you might ask, I didn't actually say anything about what the equality conditions are. And the equality condition is that there exists a quantum channel that will reverse the action on n on rho and sigma. So if you think in the strong subadditivity sense, you know, you'd have equality if and only if there's a quantum channel acting on B that can recover C. And this will come up in our discussions later, for example, about recovery of observables in the entanglement wedge. We could actually use new developments in quantum information theory from the past year to write down explicit formulas for entanglement wedge reconstruction in terms of this recovery quantum channel. That original work, I just wanted to say, the first step was to do it for strong subadditivity, and then it was generalized to relative entropy, which is a little bit harder. Yeah. Yeah. So what I would say is, you're very familiar with entropy cones, of course. So if I take all of these entropies and put them on the left-hand side, then I have a sort of a vector with coefficients of coefficients in front of entropies. You know, it'd be like +1, +1, -1, -1. And if I take a positive linear combination, and so a vector in a vector space whose basis vectors are the power set of ABC or some larger set of subsystems, a valid inequality can be thought of as a vector, and positive linear combinations of inequalities are still valid inequalities, which means that the valid inequalities form a cone. And if you ask, you know, what are the known extreme rays of that cone? It's strong subadditivity, and I forget exactly what it's called, I should know, but if you take strong subadditivity and sort of look at a purified version of it, you get another inequality that's equivalent to it. Those basically define all of the extreme rays that we know, and we don't know any others. Known inequalities. So there's no proof at this point that they're the only ones. In the case of classical entropy, you can do something similar. For classical entropy, there's an additional inequality, which is that the entropy of AB is greater than or equal to the entropy of A. That's not true for quantum entropies. So if you write down the classical entropy cone using the sort of obvious inequalities, in the 1990s, they found some new inequalities that were independent. And they have a sort of abstract characterization of the whole cone at this point, but we don't have one for quantum entropy.
I'm going to cut questions off, or at least we'll take them offline. We've got a short amount of time for a break, so let's thank Patrick again.